Paul Gansel is a software developer at Google, a core Python dev, and an open source maintainer for many projects. And he has some thoughts about PyTest's xFail. He was an early skeptic of using xFail and now is a proponent of the feature. In this episode, we talk about some open source workflows that are possible because of xFail. Welcome to Test and Code. If you've found value in this podcast, could you do me a favor? Could you go over to pythontest.com and look either in the top menu bar or in the bottom footer? And there's a few links we're going to talk about. Contact is how you can get a hold of me. Newsletter is how I can get a hold of you. And support is how you can find links to things like my book, the PyTest book, PyTest courses, the community where you can ask questions. And that's about it, really. I'd really appreciate if, especially if you could sign up for the newsletter. I'm trying to collect emails of people that might be interested in similar topics. Paul Gansel contacted me and said he wanted to talk about xFail, and I really like talking about PyTest, so I'm up for it. So, Paul, people don't remember who you are. I'm pretty sure you've been on the podcast before, right?
Yeah, I was once, I think it was 16, 18 months ago, something like that. I was talking about subtests, I think.
Right. Yeah.
And that was my last blog post before like last month or something. It was up for like 18 months. Was that I wrote a blog post about that and then just completely stopped blogging for a super long time.
So why did you feel the need to blog about xFail?
I think actually because I sort of half promised you that I would talk about xFail on a future episode of Testing Code like a long time ago, and then I felt really bad about not doing it, and I've noticed that you've been doing a couple of episodes about xFail, and I was like, okay, I should probably do this. It'll be thematically appropriate with what you've done recently, just in general, I guess I've been feeling a bit more that like creative urge to like write something down.
So do you use xFail regularly?
I try and make it a part of my development workflow. Lately I've been doing a lot more work stuff and a lot less open source. And when I do open source, it's often in CPython where it's a lot harder to use xFail. But when I have the chance, like when I'm working on Dateutil or any of my own personal projects, something that uses PyTest, I definitely like to use xFail. I think there's another blog post coming out later about how I integrate it into my personal workflow. But in general, I have a policy where, so originally I did, let me back up a second. Originally, when I first heard about xFail, I was like, what is this? Why would I use it? It seems really stupid because, you know, it's just this thing where you will put in a broken test and you'll mark it as xFail, but you won't mark it as skip, right? You're saying this test is going to fail. And I was like, why is this different than skip? And also, why would I want to check in broken tests, right? People came to me and they offered, they're like, oh, do you want me to add an xFailing test for this issue that I raised? And I was like, well, why don't we just add the test when we fix the issue? What purpose is it serving? But I was actually convinced by one of my fellow maintainers, Brock Mendel, that it actually makes sense to use xFail. I didn't really understand that the difference between xFail and skip is that xFail actually runs the test and then it sort of checks whether or not the test failed, and skip just makes it so you don't run the test at all. And the main reason why you would want these two things to be different is that when you're running the test and checking that it fails, you can actually enforce that it fails so that you know that the test is, well, you can know two things about it. One, you can know the test is working in a limited sense, right? So you know that you haven't fixed the issue and the test is failing. So when you fix the issue and get rid of the xFail, you do know that the test works because you didn't change it. It used to fail and now it succeeds. The other thing you can know is whether you fixed the test by accident or even at all, right? So generally what, by default, what happens is that if the test fails, it's marked as X-fail. And if it passes, it's marked as X-pass. I always run my test suites with strict on. So that basically says that if a test fails to fail, then that's a failure. So the test suite fails. And that way,
yeah, and that, so that's confusing to some people. And I've had to explain it to a lot of people, especially internally. And I explain it that you don't have to be afraid of the test suite failing. The test, any failure is just a message to us that we need to pay attention to something. So in the case where we get a X pass and that fails the test suite, that's a good thing because it tells us that maybe this thing is fixed and we can take the X fail out of the code. So,
yeah, I mean, I think people don't like the idea of X fail being strict because they're like, well, if I fix a bug, I don't want my CI to break because the library got better or the application got better. But I think that is based in the idea that it's like every time your test suite fails, that's like a lot of work, right? You have to, you know, fix something in the configuration or hunt down a bug, or, you know, it adds all this latency, or it's just something else to do. But in the case of X-fail, what it's really saying is like, or the only thing you really have to do is remove the X-fail decorator and then it'll start working again. Yeah. So, you know, it's not like it's going to, you know, it's going to kill your velocity or anything because you're going to have to fix all these fiddly things with the test suite. You know, I think we all have been in that sort of situation where you have a bunch of fragile tests and they keep breaking and you're like, oh, I'm just like spending all my time maintaining these tests. But with the case of X-fail, it's like, I've already written regression tests for this bug. And if you accidentally fix the bug, or even if you fix it on purpose, right? Like the test suite should start failing. And that's like, oh, check it out. Here are the tests that passed. And then you just remove that X-fail decorator. That's all you have to do. And your regression test is in place. Like it's quite nice that someone else has written your test for you. It's wonderful.
Yeah. And if all of your tests are passing now, you can pass in like run X-fail and it just ignores all those decorators if you wanted to. Like for instance, I do that with some of our, we've got like two cadences of test suite. We get the same code, but with our nightly tests, I run it with X-fails with strict, and then we're basically, that's our continuous sort of testing, and then then another one that's a slower cadence where we're purposely checking every specific version that we've changed a feature or we've changed something specifically. We know a new thing is in place. On those, I want to know absolutely everything. So we just, we use run X fail and we just turn all of those X fails off. Because there's times where you really do want to know. I mean, you can find out anyway, like even if you're the X fails are reported, but, one of the issues that comes up, and the reason why I fiddle with this a bit is a lot of CI tools have no idea what these mean. X fail and X pass just get translated into something. They either get translated into a failure or a pass or a skip. Do you have any issues with that or with working with CI?
Not really, but you know, I'm also just using I'm just using PyTest or something, so it's not that big of a problem. The way I've used X-fail, it's mostly like, since I always run it in strict mode, I don't really need to know the difference between X-fail and skip and X-pass and a failure, because if it's X-failed or if it's skipped, I don't really care. Like, because in both cases, it's like either it's skipped and that hopefully means like, all right, I this test wasn't even supposed to pass in the first place, right? It's like, this is a test, but it's a test for something that doesn't apply in this particular condition, right? It's a test that only is run on Windows, or it's only run in a certain time zone or something like that. Yeah. Whereas if it's X-fail, it's like, this should be passing, so I'm going to run it anyway, but it doesn't pass because there's something wrong with the library and I want to fix it. From the point of view of someone who's like of the version of me who doesn't care about that test, who's just running the entire test suite, I don't need to make a distinction between those two cases, right? It's only when I'm adding the test in the first place that I want to make that distinction, or when something about that changes, right? Like when I fix the bug, I want to be notified immediately. So for me, if it's like a failure, then it's like, oh, something failed, and I'll just look and see what it was, and it's because this thing X passed. So yeah, I mean, I suppose that you could make affirmative assertions about like if you don't actually care about the difference between X pass and a failure, you could make affirmative assertions about failures in the code itself by being like with pytest.raises whatever assertion error, value error, something like that, and then put your test in that block. But I do think the downside to that is that you actually have to muck around with the test itself rather than removing just the decorator, which changes how the result is interpreted.
Yeah, and I don't really like using the you can call X fail within the code also, but it behaves differently. So people should watch out for that. I'm kind of annoyed with that. So the decorator runs everything. But if you call like pytest X fail from a test, if it fails, it stops there. It's like an assert. It doesn't continue with the test. And that's annoying to me. I wish it didn't do that. So I would recommend people just forget that you can call xfail from within a test.
Yeah, I think the only time that I've tried to use xfail within a test, I do remember it being mildly irritating, but the one place where I've had trouble introducing xfail is in the setup tools test suite, where essentially, I think they've marked a bunch of stuff as xfail or skip. It's not consistently used, whether it's like this is a bug that we have tests for, that aren't working, or whether it's like this is, this doesn't work on this particular platform. But I tried to move it over to everything xfail is strict, and then like just go through and try and update whatever I find to be xfail. But the problem is setup tools has this very large matrix of supported platforms and combinations of supported platforms. And some of the bugs only are exhibited in like very weird niche edge cases that's really hard to express as a single conditional in like the xfail decorator. So what ends up happening is you end up getting a lot of X passes on Windows with this version of MSVC or MSCV or whatever it's called, but not with this other version. And then it just ends up being like, or you have something where the bug is just, it's flaky, it works sometimes and other times it doesn't work. So that's one case where it's really hard to make xfail strict only. I could just make those tests marked explicitly as strict equals false and make the default strict equals true. But I just remember it being sort of pervasive and related. The reason I brought this up in relation to calling xfail inside of the test is that a similar place that I've seen is when I'm using hypothesis tests, right? And I have a whole bunch of cases that pass and then a couple of bugs that show up only in certain parts of the test input space. Those are not, you want to sort of conditionally xfail based on, say I have this function and it works well for everything that's a positive number and zero, but if it's a negative number, I've got a bug in it and I'm not ready to fix the bug right now. So then I can either use hypothesis.assume, right? Like I can call the assume function and then just have hypothesis never generate those inputs or just have hypothesis skip those assumptions, or rather those inputs. But that is sort of like skipping the test instead of using xfail on it. So instead I'll sort of say conditionally, like, all right, if hypothesis gave me this thing, xfail it. And I don't think Hypothesis deals with that super well. I think some, I've seen some of the problems you've seen where like it stops running the test or whatever. I don't remember the exact problems with it. I think it might be better than the alternatives, but it's like, it could use a little bit of love. And hopefully this podcast and the blog posts will convince people to use XFail enough that that it will have a higher profile in both Hypothesis and PyTest.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope people will use it a lot. But I do find that using XFail, and at first I like to use it for my own personal stuff, but for group projects, it was just more work than it was worth to explain it to everybody. I try not to put it on. I personally don't try not to put it on things that are intended to be fixed soon, because it's okay just to see those failures until we fix the bug. So knowing when to mark something as X fail is kind of a project per project sort of thing that you need to know. I definitely understand like an open source project where you don't want to fail the test suite, but you'd like to have the test in place. That makes sense to leave some X fails there, because somebody else can work on it and try to fix those. And it's nice to have the test already there instead of having to, where else would you put it? If you didn't put it in there in the suite and mark it as XFail, where would you put it? You'd have to, you know, put it on a branch or something, I guess.
I mean, in the past, what I was doing before was that people would raise an issue in the issue tracker, and then I would say, they would either have a nice minimal reproducer, or I would, minimize whatever, you know, I would reproduce the behavior, and then I would minimize that to a very small reproducer and be like, okay, if this chunk of code were to pass, then, you know, then that would be, you know, then that would be a fix for the bug, right? Like here's a minimal reproducer, right? And theoretically what you could do is you just, you know, copy and paste that into the test suite, add an assertion in it, and then that's your test. So now I think what I'll do is I'll usually offer to the person and say, if you would like to add an X-failing test to the test suite, please do, you know, because I'm always looking for ways to recognize people who contribute good issues. You know, because I think people see, you know, oh, I made a pull request and it got merged as like I contributed to the library, whereas I told someone about a problem is not seen as a contribution in the same way that a pull request is, because it doesn't involve writing code. You know, but knowing,
writing an X failing test is writing code.
Yeah, so. Exactly. You know, so like when I say like that's why I like to say like, okay, you know, you don't need to make an X failing test. From my point of view, you've still made a valuable contribution to this library or this program by just, you know, giving me a good bug report, making it possible for me to reproduce it, creating a public artifact that people can find to know, oh, okay, this is or is not the intended behavior of the library. All of those things are very valuable to me. But if you want to see your name on a commit, or you just don't mind and you like to be, you know, helpful, saying, okay, well, why don't you take your minimal reproducer, throw it in the test suite. I am acknowledging as the maintainer that this is a bug that we want to fix. So if you add the test and you mark it as XFail, we'll merge it. And then, you know, hopefully, you know, either it'll get fixed by, you know, on purpose and someone will remove that XFail decorator, or it'll get fixed accidentally. And then we will have a regression test in place immediately, you know, because this bug doesn't exist anymore after I refactored X, Y, and Z.
So you brought up a setup tools and a couple other projects. How many open source projects do you work on or do you keep track?
I mean, on average, it's like closer to zero these days because I have young children and I don't have very much time to work on these things. I used to be very active maintaining setup tools and dateutil, and I'm still burst mode active in maintaining CPython as a core dev, mainly working on daytime and zone info. And then there's a handful of other projects that I either have a commit bit or, from some small amount of work that I did at some point, or I just know the code base enough that I can make a couple pull requests, and the maintainers know me well enough that they're gonna look at my that we have a rapport enough that I can get things merged probably easier than your random person off the street, which is maybe not fair, but maintainer time is limited, and it's always easier to be like, oh, this guy's made 10 really high quality pull requests. I'll review his pull request because it's probably not it's probably not going to be a ton of work to get it merged.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I have a fairly decent track record of having defect reports get fixed or at least get a snarky reply, because people already know my personality and know that I'm not going to be offended, I think. But I think partly it's because I was just thinking about that. Is being able to write a good defect report. So you said like a minimal reproducible code to reproduce the defect. And if you can write that as a test, it's great. One of the things, and that like, instantly somebody can work on that project. Like if you write an X failing test as part of a defect report, that would be cool because the person that wants to fix it doesn't have to go out and write a test or figure out how they can just run your test, and then they see the failure and voila, you can start working on it. That would be cool. But the same sort of thing is like, what is that minimally reproducible process? And that's being able to come up with a small example, because people usually don't run into the problem because they have a small example. They have like a big thing that they're working on and they run into a problem. And then to take that extra time and try to boil it down into a small example of how this fails, it's very welcoming, right?
Yeah. I mean, Matt Rockland has a really good, blog post on this called Craft Minimal Bug Reports. And I actually linked to it from my How and Why I Use PyTest XFail blog post. And he, it's basically the same thing as Stack Overflow says as well, right? Which is that like the more work you can do to make it easy for a maintainer to just reproduce your problem, see exactly what the problem is, and then, get as close as possible to the source of the problem, the better, right? So
yeah.
In some cases, like, I know that there have been a couple bugs in pandas where I actually cloned pandas and, like I had a minimal reproducer and I also knew it was a regression because I knew that something used to work. And I actually cloned pandas and then I did a git bisect where I found the exact commit where the problem broke. And then I, at that point, the question was like, do I make a pull request to fix it or do I make an issue? If it's something very simple, you can make a pull request. But I think at that point I was like, well, this is in some part of the code base that I've never touched before. And I don't know what trade-offs need to be made. So I just wrote up an issue that's like, here's a minimal reproducer. Here's the commit that it broke on. here is what I think you should do. And I think maintainers, that's a lot of effort to go through. But I think the key is that maintainers will see what effort you put in, and you should sort of put in as much effort as you feel comfortable putting in, without having to, and just try and estimate where the trade-off is between like, all right, I don't know this, like someone who knows this library really well will be able to do the next part of fixing the bug in 10 minutes, even though it would take me 2 hours. So maybe that's the point where you hand it off as an issue, right? Whereas if it's like anyone can do this or spend 30 seconds doing it or spend 5 minutes, maybe I'll spend 10 minutes or maybe you say, all right, I really want this bug to be fixed. So I'll spend an extra 20 minutes writing a really nice bug report. When I know that the the maintainer could spend 5 minutes, finding out the same exact information. And you can also keep in mind that there's a multiplier there, right? Because there's probably 20 users who can write bug reports for at least 20 users who are writing bug reports for every one maintainer for some of these, for some of these projects.
Right. And like you said, a lot of times it's volunteer. I mean, it's volunteer time. And people have kids and lives and jobs. So if you can make it to the point where, I mean, especially if it's important for you to get it fixed, if it's stopping your progress on something and it's a problem, you kind of want to get it fixed, right? So if you can make it so that the maintainer can look at it and go, oh, I know where I know exactly where this is, or oops, I forgot something. I intended to do something different or whatever. If it can boil it down to just an hour or so of work on their part, it's a great benefit. You'll probably get it fixed really quick.
Yeah. And you know, I think my hope is that the way I've got this blog post structured, it's aimed at both people who want to make these sorts of bug reports and people who want to accept PRs that have X-Fail. I mean, I guess it's mainly more like why you as a maintainer of a code base should want X-Failing tests in your code base. Yeah. But I think it'll be useful on both sides, right? Because if you're a maintainer and you're convinced of this, you can say to people who come to your library with bug reports, hey, do you want to make a PR? You can get a commit with your name on it, making this X-Failing test. And if you are the kind of person who's writing these tests, you know, I suspect that on average, if you make if you start with a PR instead of a bug report or something, if you make a PR that has an X-Failing test in it, most people are going to be like, what is this? Why are you adding broken tests to my test suite? Of course, I'm not going to merge this.
Okay. So a better thing would be start with a defect, offer to make a test, maybe possibly in that defect report, or at least in the conversation. If somebody admits that, yeah, that probably shouldn't happen. When should you propose doing a X-Failing test?
I mean, if it's easy enough, you really can just open a pull request with the X-Failing test and be like, you don't have to merge this, but I just thought I would use it as a demonstration so that you can, you know, look at it on CI or whatever.
So you're going to link those two. You're going to link the defect report and the pull request together.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can make it right away, or you can just start with like, you know, just put the X-Failing test in the issue, particularly if you don't care about seeing it run on CI right away. And then you say, would you like me to add this to the test suite? Like, I'm happy to do that. And then you can also link to my blog post and say like,
Paul says to do this.
Yeah. Or just, you know, I'm convinced by what's in here. And, you know, honestly, that's half the reason I blog for these things, is that I end up spending a lot of time explaining to people, oh, you shouldn't be invoking setup.py directly, or subtests are a good thing, or this is how datetime arithmetic works, right? And after you explain the same thing two times, three times, four times, you start kind of wanting a canonical document where you can be like, here's something that will take you 15 minutes to read, and it's the general argument for it.
Well, I appreciate this because I talk about it, but it seems a little weird for me at work to say, you should go read my blog post about why we should do this. So, but I have no problem with linking to yours, even at work, and saying, oh, this is why we're X-Failing things. Go read Paul's blog post. So it's good. Yeah. So thank you.
Well, I mean, I also don't want to, I always shrink people like to be like, oh, you're a setup tools maintainer or a CPython core dev. And, you know, so we should listen to you. And I want to say like, look, I'm just like a guy. And, that's one reason why I write these sorts of blog posts, because I try and put my reasoning there so that independent of whether or not, I am any sort of authority. I mean, you can certainly use it as a heuristic as to whether or not to spend 10 or 15 minutes reading my blog post, but you should also evaluate for yourself. You know, like, this is just something I was convinced of, and I want to lay out the argument in such a way that people understand it. They have it framed well, and then they can make a decision, right? They can say, well, we don't really want to put 100 X failing tests in our test suite every single time. Like, you know, we don't want to spend the CI resources on it or whatever. And that's a choice that you can make. And then other people will say, oh, this would actually be very useful, and it'll be a great way to engage our contributors. And I think both of these outcomes are fine as long as you have made them, you've been exposed to all the best arguments.
It also doesn't have to be a large thing. So we've talked about it for a long time, but one of the projects I'm working on is we're using XFail. We're using it with, like I've talked about before, using with strict equals true so that we know when things start passing, and with and then at times when we're close to releasing, we just turn off all XFails. But it's a small number. I think one of the projects I'm on, there's currently 3 tests that are X-failing out of thousands. We've got thousands of test cases. There's 3 that we're watching. That's really what it is. These are ones that we're watching. We're watching to see, if they're fixed, and we want to get them fixed quickly. If it's something that we're not planning on fixing because we've just made a decision that we're changing it's not important because of financial reasons, it's too much of a corner case, then we'll probably modify the test suite to define the behavior different. And we just know that this behaves this way now. I don't know if I'd be comfortable with it with a code base with hundreds of X fails. But like, I don't know. Have you used projects with like lots of X fails?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think anything that's going to accumulate that many X fails is probably going to be distributed enough that it's, right. So the place where I could imagine seeing hundreds of X fails, right, is in like the CPython standard library, or even like pandas or NumPy or something, where, you know, you get these bugs, and you have multiple maintainers who are all responsible for their own various individual areas, and there's not necessarily continuity of maintainership. And so, there are CPython bugs that I've seen fixed. A lot of them, they get reported, and then they get fixed 6, 8, 10 years later. Having X-fails for all those bugs would probably spend a lot of time carrying around CI resources spent on something that is just really not going to accidentally fix itself. But I've also seen plenty of times where it's like, hey, I think we actually fixed this when we switched from Python 2.7 to Python 3. This turned out, we just looked in, we saw that this was a bug. We didn't investigate what the cause was. Turns out the cause was something in a dependency, and then the dependency got fixed. These sorts of things, you can actually end up spending a bunch of time when you go to investigate the bug only to find out that it's not reproducible anymore.
Also, large projects like CPython, for instance, or other pandas, or like you said, there's a lot of maintainers, but there are some of them that might be willing to touch any part of the code. But like, for instance, you said on CPython, you kind of focus on like date util, date time. Yeah. So, and that's true for a lot of projects where the area of focus where somebody's looking at is a narrow focused area. So they're going to keep track of the kind of bugs that are in their area, however they want to. So they're kind of like little projects within big projects.
Yeah. And I've seen in CPython a situation recently where, something in the test suite itself, of date time, I think there was something in import lib where, not import lib, in the test support for importing modules. It comes up when you have a C module and a pure Python module. Sometimes you'll want to use one or the other. And you have to like mess around with the state of, you know, like the global state that keeps track of which modules are imported. Like you have to delete certain modules and then try and clean up after them. And there was some issue with how certain modules were getting frozen or how they were getting deleted and re-added in. And it came up in a couple of different, it had multiple manifestations throughout the code base. And then someone fixed it and then they went through and then I was like, well, I think this also closes this other issue. But it, you know, if I had had X failing tests that are like, this is supposed to be working, but it's not, that person would have immediately, you know, when they went to go fix their own issue, they would have been like, oh, this actually closes this other issue as well. And then they would close both issues, remove the X failing test, and it turns into a regression test. And I'm not going to see that regression.
That's nice. Actually, so I take that back. Put in X fails as much as you can, because it would be nice.
Yeah, I mean, but the main question is resources, right? Like if these tests are very resource intensive, or they're a substantial portion of your test suite, and the test suite is is taking up a lot of CI time, then you may want to make some decisions. I suspect that you will not get to that point, right? I suspect that even someone who wholeheartedly adopts this method is not going to see more than 5 or 10% of their test suite being used on X fails.
Yeah, I agree. And it's up to you. But one of the things that X fails do is they make you think about your test suite more, because it's a dynamic living thing. It's not a static thing that you write a test and forget about it. And it also, you have to talk about it more. People have to understand the test suite and talk about it more, which is a good thing. So that's good. I've got tons of questions for you, so I hope you're willing to come back. You are going to write about the workflow, so we definitely need to talk about that sometime. And I'd also like to talk at some point about your experience as a core contributor to CPython, because that sounds interesting. But thanks so much, Paul, for coming on the show today and talking about this.
Oh yeah, no problem. I definitely enjoyed it. And yeah, I know I think I have a couple more, XFail blog posts coming out in the near future, and I'm always happy to talk about that kind of thing.
Talk to you next time.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Testing Code. Let's keep in touch. Head over to pythontest.com/contact. to reach out to me, or /newsletter so that I can reach you, or /support if you'd like to, you know, get a course or something. That's all for now. Now go out and test something.